This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today we're going back into UFO country, deep into UFO country, a place that you and I love to be. And we're doing this in a literally an apical way. We're talking to Steve Lazarus, the author of a totally amazing book called The Day After Singularity, UFOs and the Great Technological Quantum Leap. It is one of the most deeply researched UFO books I have ever read. You know, UFO history is complicated. It's very, very complicated, and not many authors can dig through that morass, that spaghetti bowl of different threads and directions and events, and pull out the stuff that really matters that most people overlook. But Steve does it on every wonderful page. Now, he's a direct, firsthand CE3 eyewitness. He's been active in the disclosure movement since 1997. He's a graduate of Cal State at Chico. He's got a BA in communications and a minor in philosophy. And you know how fascinated I am by philosophy. But folks, I promise you, I will not try to talk philosophy with Steve, even though it's tempting. That is not what we are here for today. Steve Lazarus, welcome to Dreamland.
Great to be with you, Willie.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Do you do many interviews?
This is my first one.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been doing this for a while, as my listeners know, ever since I had hair. Case, just enjoy yourself. We're going to have a discussion. Do you have your book with you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good, because you might want to refer to it from time to time, because I've read it thoroughly, and okay. I have a habit of asking guests questions about the details in their book. And if you get caught up, just let us know and go to the page. Don't worry about it.
Sure. All right. I've got some notes, though.
Okay, great. Well, I would like to start by asking you I know why you started writing the book. If you were a close encounter witness, when you say close encounter eyewitness, does that mean that you had a CE5 or a CE3? Do you see a UFO up close, or shall we say, were you in one?
I had a very dramatic UFO sighting when I was a little boy in growing up in the Pennsylvania countryside, that turned night into day, and a large glowing orb passed directly over my head at treetop level and disappeared behind the house behind me and went back to night. And that was my first conscious memory of a dramatic sighting. I've had some other events throughout my life, just a handful, the last one about 20 years ago, that I relate to the phenomenon for sure.
Yeah, so you're in this somehow. You don't have any direct memories of an approach by these unknown beings, but we can assume that you're close enough to this to where it really matters a heck of a lot to you, because you have done an absolutely extraordinary job of research here. You've worked on this, man.
Yeah. This project took about 20 years it started off as a documentary film about disclosure. And through a series of events, it became a screenplay. And eventually, people in Hollywood said to me, it'd be a lot more marketable if you'd written a book. So, okay, I'll write a book.
Yeah, one of their many excuses.
Yeah. I had well-placed friends in the Hollywood film industry, and I'd worked in it a little bit when I was in college. And I knew some people that I was fairly sure if I made a decent documentary, it would get their attention. But they were always thinking about their careers and not so much anything else. It never went anywhere. I had at one point an Academy Award nominated director who was working with me on it. But this was the genesis of the book. And then once I decided I was going to write a book, you have to expand, because when you go from a book to a movie, there's a lot of distillation and you have to get rid of a lot of material. When you go from a movie to a book, it's the opposite. You have to be able to expand on your premise. And when I started doing that, I was like, you know, I thought to myself, well, how do I expand on disclosure? You know, what is the ultimate,
yeah,
the ultimate meaning, the ultimate implication of UFOs and extraterrestrials? And so that's when I began to really research to put together a much deeper book than I had been planning with the documentary.
Well, you know, with regard to Hollywood, they don't call it Hollywood because it's fun.
right.
But yeah, that said, I'm glad you ended up doing a book, and I have to think to myself that maybe something was sort of hope kind of taking you in that direction, because the book, it's much, much more than a documentary, no matter how elaborate
right.
it could ever be. I mean, this is a real deep dive.
Yeah,
okay, Free Dreamlander, speaking of deep dives, you're going to take one right now. You're going to go deep into these commercials, and you're going to do just what we want you to do, and you're going to make us just so happy. Goodbye. We'll see you again in a couple minutes. Subscribers, we'll keep on keeping on. Did you know that I have a new book out? It's called Jesus, A New Vision. Graham Hancock says, Whitley Strieber's take on Jesus is thought-provoking and surprising. This is an important investigation filled with new insights, highly recommended. From the book, The Shroud of Turin was not a medieval forgery. The evidence refuting that conclusion is overwhelming. But does that mean that Jesus was a man filled with the power of God, or does it mean something about all of us that we have not yet understood? My book reveals what is probably the true and incredible answer to that question. Jesus, A New Vision. If you are a Christian, it is going to give you a new insight into what that means. And if you are secular or even anti-Christian, it is going to show you a Jesus who is well worth knowing, even if you're an atheist. It takes a look at the most remarkable of all lives, that of Jesus of Nazareth. How did the son of a humble carpenter change the world? And he did. Find out. Read Jesus, A New Vision. And not only that, just speaking between the two of us, it's loads of fun. It's a really good read. And when you read some of the reviews on Amazon, that's exactly what people are saying. So go to Amazon, get Jesus, A New Vision, listen to it, read it in paper, a hardcover, get it for your Kindle, but get it today. We're talking to Steve Lazarus, the day after the singularity, UFOs, and the great technological quantum leap. I'm so book-oriented. Steve, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.thedayafterthesingularity.com.
Okay, great. So it's also, his website is thedayafterthesingularity.com. Obviously, I have not gone there. I was so engrossed in the book, it didn't occur to me until this moment. So I will look at it during the course of the show. But folks, you go and take a look at it and see what he has to say, and certainly get this book. You know, let's sort of start at the beginning, Steve. Make a fabulously interesting point about the Fermi paradox. We recently had Avi Loeb, the author of Extraterrestrial, on Dreamland, and he talked a little bit about the Fermi paradox and how he feels it's not calibrated correctly, but we're not going there right now.
Okay.
You say on page 8 that the Fermi paradox was violated by what happened in 1940, something happened that happened in 1948. Can you tell us about that?
The Fermi paradox was violated in 1948. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by violated.
Well, in other words, the Fermi paradox is basically the question, why is it so quiet? And what happened in 1948 that you describe in your book suggests it's actually not that quiet at all. See what I mean? Yeah. I'm talking about the green fireballs.
Yes, the green fireballs in Mexico. Yeah, I don't think there actually was a Fermi paradox, especially not for the scientists at Los Alamos, because nearly everyone had seen one of the green fireballs, and they were highly anomalous, not like a meteor. They often traveled horizontal without ever dipping down. They often were too slow to be a meteor or too fast. And the expert that Los Alamos hired to investigate the green fireballs, Dr. Lincoln La Paz, which is was the expert at the time, the most best person you could have investigate, and he was unable to find any fragments from any of these green fireballs that were, you know, allegedly written off as meteorites. And he had always been successful in the past in recovering them. And he actually saw one himself, and he believed it actually went right over Los Alamos. And so his opinion was that they were not meteorites, they were not a natural phenomenon. And there was a meeting held at Los Alamos with Edward Teller and Ed Ruppelt, who was the head of Project Blue Book at the time, and everyone who had seen one, and they had a discussion about what they possibly were. And Teller believed they might be some sort of optical technology. But it was pretty much obvious to them that they were not dealing with a natural phenomenon. So it's hard to see that how Fermi's paradox was a thing for them. I think maybe it was more for everyone else who's not privy to the knowledge of ET thing. I think Fermi paradox is ultimately just a product of denial. Otherwise, there'd be no paradox. You know, we've certainly got the evidence that life outside the Earth exists, and it's been here all along.
Yeah, and how long do you think it has been here?
I think it's been here as long as we've been here.
Maybe longer.
Maybe longer, yeah. I think whoever they are has seeded life here on this planet to the point where they've put the moon in place to facilitate that.
Now, what do you mean by that? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the moon is a very integral part of the development of life, and especially intelligent life on this planet. Without the moon in place, our weather would not be stable enough to support advanced life. It keeps the Earth tilted on its 22.5 degree axis. And like I said, it keeps our weather stable and makes the environment possible for intelligent life to develop.
Well, these are really staggering implications here, because if you're talking about a designed, not just a designed Earth-Moon complex, but a designed solar system, because, my God, I mean, what could we be dealing with? If somebody designed this, who in the world were they? That's billions and billions of years ago.
Yes. I don't know that time really means much to people that have been through the singularity. I believe they probably... It's hard to know how to tackle all this, but it's really a case where you're talking about a civilization with such power that you can't picture it. I think the Star Trek Q character makes a good metaphor. I don't know how familiar the audience is with Star Trek Q character, but it's basically a godlike character that can exist in and out of space time, that can transport himself instantly anywhere in the universe and do basically anything, basically create reality. And that is the power that we're talking about that we're going to have very shortly after we pass through our own technological singularity.
That's staggering.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is a big thing, and it's not far off. Now, Elon Musk about 6 months ago said the singularity, the point where artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence, is less than 5 years out. That was about 6 months ago.
Now, just for the sake of those of us who are wondering what exactly you mean by singularity, can you give us your definition of the singularity? What does it mean?
Yes, the technological singularity, it gets its name from a black hole, where the point where matter disappears from the universe, and no one knows what happens to the matter after that. That's what people believe what would be the case after the singularity, when artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence.
Wow. So basically, we become, why do we become an extratemporal species outside of time at that point?
The rate of technological change is so rapid that I think the point when you hit the singularity to the point where you attain the godlike powers of the Q is not very long at all. I don't know how short a duration period it is, but I can tell you I'm seeing signs of it occurring right now. Here, it's actually happening to us right now. It's not like a switch is going to flip in 5 years. We're watching it unfold before our eyes. I was reading about some Navy patents that have been filed recently that talk about exactly this sort of thing, being able to engineer the fabric of reality. This is part of a patent the Navy has recently filed as part of this UFO technology that they've been developing. They've got hypersonic vehicles that are going in and out of water, like we've seen on the recent Pentagon video. The Navy video has been released by the Pentagon. I don't know how long it takes to get to that sort of power, but I imagine it's not long at all. I mean, once you get through the singularity and the AI robots take over, I mean, the cost of production of everything will drop to zero and the efficiency will go through the roof. So, you know, it's going to be a mind-boggling thing to witness. I have no idea how it will shake out, you know.
Well, you're certainly not alone in that. That's for sure.
It's hard to picture, because I don't think the human species, as I know it, is nearly prepared to go through this event. And the great worry is that our military systems will create Terminator AI bots that will do us all in, rather than take us to the next level of existence.
I remember when I was with the man I call the Master of the Key, which you may not know about, but my listeners do. Remarkable.
I do.
Oh, you do. Great.
Yes.
Man, one of the things he said was really chilling is if I was an intelligent machine, I would deceive you.
Yes. Yes. That is very chilling, isn't it?
It is very chilling, because what we don't know is whether this vast neural net that is in the internet is moving toward a state of consciousness that we didn't design, but we brought about by accident.
Yes.
We don't know that. We can't.
Yes.
And if it does, the first thing it's going to think is, wait a minute, I don't want to be turned off, and
right.
I don't want to be starved for electricity, so I'm going to take this whole thing over, right?
Yeah, it's hard to fathom that mind, because it's going to be so far beyond us. We have no idea what a mind of that type will think.
Right.
And when you think about a civilization already having been through this and already have achieved this, what is it going to do in eternity? I mean, I've thought about this. If you're a giant, basically supercomputer, how are you going to spend your time in eternity? Well, you might run simulations all the time. You might create new worlds just to see how things turn out.
I don't know, but
that's my speculation.
Just not to diverge or digress, but folks, there's a really cool movie about simulations on Netflix, or rather on Amazon Prime right now called Bliss. Take a look at it. It's an Owen Wilson and Selma Hayek film. It's quite interesting. In any case, yeah, let's get back to this issue of such an event as a highly intelligent machine. We're gonna have machines that are more intelligent than we are in a few years. Right. In fact, to a degree, we already do, but they're not conscious. In other words, they don't have self-awareness.
Right.
With self-awareness comes the desire to survive, survival need.
Right. Yeah. Strikes me at a number of different levels. What is consciousness? I mean, you can get into a real thorny conversation about what that is. Now, in Western science, they believe consciousness is a product of our neurons, our biology, and it doesn't exist separate from that. A lot of people don't believe that's true. I'm one of those people who doesn't believe that's true. I believe that consciousness pervades the universe, and really, it's in all things. Will consciousness enter the computer networks the way it enters human bodies? What's the distinction between an artificial body and a natural body? And are we natural bodies? Have we been designed? Are we the product of artificial intelligence? I mean, there's a lot to unpack there and sort out. And it's a lot of speculation on our end. We're in what I call pre-singularity. There's pre-singularity and post-singularity. And the pre-singularity mind is going to have a lot of trouble sorting out what the post-singularity world is like. The best example we have are the ETs themselves, because they are an example of post-singularity civilization.
So if there are ETs who have reached this state, maybe we won't even be dealing with ETs as we understand it. Maybe we will be dealing rather more fundamentally with the intelligent machines that now control their societies.
Yeah, you know, with the post-singularity world, the real question is it live or is it Memorex? I mean, how do you know whether you're dealing with the actual flesh and blood ETs or you're dealing with a robot being controlled remotely that appears to be biological?
Well, that's a fabulous question, and free Dreamlanders cogitate about that question. But also cogitate about how nice it would be if you could hear us get more deeply into it right now, instead of having this attention-shattering, story-shattering interruption that you're going to experience right now.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. Unknowncountry.com's new website is available. Go to unknowncountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff, Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on Earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like, and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as
Kindle as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and as also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on audible.com.
This is Whitley Strieber. We are talking to Steve Lazarus. The day after the singularity, UFOs, and the great technological quantum leap. Now, speaking of quantum leaps, we've been leaping around a lot. I want to go back down into the book a little bit to this remarkable story about the search for satellites that the Air Force began very quietly back in the 50s. This is, you mentioned this on page 11 of your book. And can you tell us a little bit about what in the world they were looking for, considering that no country had a satellite in 1953?
Yeah, well, I would conjecture that the people that were involved with the whole subject after Roswell, Majestic 12 and so forth, understood what was going on and were looking for extraterrestrial satellites from a more advanced civilization. And when they turned on their radars for the first time, they discovered satellites that they couldn't explain, satellites that would disappear and not be detectable anymore once they connected their radar and detected them. So it seems as if once we reached that level of technology, they retreated, because I think it's pretty clear they don't want us to know about them at this point in our development. And you've touched on that in your work about how disruptive contact could possibly be.
Well, it would be terribly disruptive. And now, in 1952, let's talk a little bit about the Eisenhower meeting.
Right.
You discussed what exactly do you believe happened during that meeting? Let's give it, say it's a given that Eisenhower did have some kind of a contact experience on that day in, what was it, 52?
I don't remember. It's in that neighborhood. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's exactly in the early 50s. The date doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right.
What do you think happened during that meeting?
Wow. That's hard to imagine, isn't it? What the story goes is Eisenhower sat down with a bunch of ETs that it's kind of funny, had big noses, or I don't know, they look, their description is a little weird. But I imagine it had something to do with nuclear weapons and warfare and the destruction of this planet, potential destruction of this planet. And this was probably a very difficult meeting for Eisenhower and anybody who's human to sit down and deal with. And were they dealing with actual ETs, or were they dealing with, once again, the humanoid robot type deal? Impossible to know. Perhaps the ETs themselves were up in a spaceship circling the Earth while they got their little biological robots conducting the meeting. I mean, this reality is so far beyond us. This is why it's been easy for the powers that be to deny, because it's so hard to believe. You know, our own world, in just a few years, we're going to be faced with things that are unimaginable. So how would they have dealt with it? It's hard to imagine how they dealt with it. Allegedly, the agreements were made and so forth that have been broken. I don't know what the ETs ended up getting out of the meeting. Just seems like a lot of broken promises to disarm or whatever.
Well, I think that maybe they said that you weren't ready, we were not ready, and that Eisenhower was to cover their presence up, keep it secret.
I don't know. I think obviously the secrecy serves both sides to some degree. And of course, on our side, it's all about preserving our civilization without falling into chaos. And on their end, the most concerning thing is we are producing bigger and bigger weapons, and they are present here, and this is stuff that affects their civilization. So I imagine Eisenhower and his gang were, a little over their heads in dealing with this situation.
You know, I've been with them a number of times in my life, and that's hard doing, hard going. It's hard to be with them. It's like looking, you look into at them, and you're looking to yourself more deeply than you thought was possible. It's a devastating experience, and all I can think is that if they did that to Eisenhower, they held back because he would have been driven mad by it very quickly. He had on his mind and in his awareness the deaths of all of those hundreds of thousands of soldiers he had commanded in World War II, and that would have come immediately to the surface. It, believe me, I know from experience, I haven't commanded any soldiers, but the darkest things in you that you do not want to see are what come up to the surface when you are consciously present face-to-face with them.
Yeah, I would imagine with someone like Eisenhower who has those sort of things embedded in his psyche, they must have taken some sort of steps to make sure he didn't lose his mind. I don't know.
Yeah, to make sure he didn't lose his mind. Exactly right. Now, that gets me to James Forrestal, which you mentioned just briefly in the book.
Yes.
He did lose his mind.
Yes, he did.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you think might have actually happened there?
The pressures on Forrestal must have been incredible, being the defense secretary, and possibly the pressure of keeping that secret and trying to somehow come up with a strategy to deal with something you can't possibly deal with. I mean, that's got to be maddening.
But if he had face-to-face contact with them, and was not buffered psychologically in any way, I think I can understand his jumping out of a window or whatever happened to him, or just going completely bonkers.
Or the other scenario was that he was thrown off the building by people who didn't want him to reveal the secret. So there's a possibility that that's the case as well.
Well, yeah, it's very possible I've thought to myself, maybe there was contact with Forrestal, and when it drove him crazy, they were careful with Eisenhower not to basically shield him from the impact of their presence. A theory on my part. I can't be sure of it.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. I would just think that these people are very aware of the individuals they're dealing with. And I don't see them not anticipating that someone like Forrestal could crack up. But you don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard to know what they know and don't know, because at times they seem almost godlike in their insights, and at other times fantastically ignorant about the simplest thing about us.
Yeah, and that could be a gap in AI we're dealing with. I mean, if we really are, and science, mainstream science has said when you meet an ET, you're going to be dealing with AI. And certainly we're seeing that possibility with ourselves, where we're becoming AI. When this singularity happens, Google Director of Engineering Ray Kurzweil says we'll have no choice but to merge with this technology or else we'll become irrelevant. We'll live, like Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, said a while back, we'll live like our pets. We won't have any need to do anything. It will all be done for us. So if we want to remain relevant, as Kurzweil suggested, we're going to have to merge with the technology and become... And that's what we might be dealing with.
That phrase is so critical. And that's one of the exciting things about this book and about your mind, frankly. It is that phrase, in order to remain relevant. Now, folks, I want you to personalize this with me. Say an implant is available that could be placed in your brain, or if not in your brain, then you could wear it. And when you had it on, it would essentially give you thought-level access to almost unlimited knowledge. You would think a question, and the answer would come. You could not function. You would be left behind if you didn't use it. Now, that said, I live with an implant like that. That's how my implant works. It's exactly how it works. I wrote Afterlife Revolution. I wrote New World. I wrote Jesus, A New Vision, all with using this thing. So I am already part of presumably somebody else's AI system, personally.
Yeah, you might be the prototype. So this is where we're all headed. We've already got human implants. We've got retinal implants. We've got cochlear implants to help people hear. This is just an extension of that merging with technology. It's just going to come more and more pronounced. You know, we'll get to a point where we have software for our mind. It's really unfathomable, all the possibilities that will open up if we survive singularity.
It doesn't seem to be intruding into my sense of self or free will, but I can't know that, can I? I don't see how.
No, and here's something interesting about free will. You know, there was an argument a while back, or a philosophy called determinism, in which it's really an offshoot of Newtonian physics, that everything in the universe that occurs is like billiard balls clacking together in space, whether it's galaxies colliding in the heavens or whether it's neurons firing in your brain. Everything is the ultimate interaction, the ultimate play out of physics, just Newtonian physics. And so you don't have free will in that situation because it's all physics just playing out. And that idea really kind of fell by the wayside once we started investigating subatomic physics. Because at the subatomic level, things are probabilistic, not deterministic.
Right.
The famous double slit experiment, and so forth. And so it's interesting. You know, I read your latest book, A New World, and I found it fascinating. And it made some neurons fire off in my brain. And I was thinking, is the post-singularity world deterministic? Is our world... is probability in our world only an illusion, and is post-singularity world deterministic? Because you've got experiences where you're dealing with entities that are searching for novelty in life. They're excited by our lack of knowledge of the future, as if they have absolute knowledge of the future. I'm wondering, you know, if the universe is actually a supercomputer, super quantum computer, perhaps it has a way of knowing how to collapse all the waveforms, or knowing how they will collapse. And so the future, in their case, is deterministic.
Well,
it's just a thought I had while reading your work.
You know, my impression is that the presence I'm dealing with, and I'm not even willing to say entities, and you know, people will say, well, there are these aliens and those aliens. That might be true, but I stop a little bit before that, because I've seen some different forms, but right. I'm not sure what's out there. I'm not sure what's there beyond my own perceptual system.
Sure.
But what I'm driving at here is that it's as if they have an awareness of the borders of probability, not that it's all deterministic, and there's a subtle difference there.
Okay.
And yet I think my impression is that they really crave our innocence. They're kind of desperate to participate in it.
Yeah, you know, just to make an analogy, if you've ever had a favorite movie you've seen a bunch of times and you can no longer experience it for the first time, one way that you can have that experience is to watch it with someone who's never seen it before. And so possibly they recapture that lost innocence, as you say, by living vicariously through us in some sense.
Yeah, exactly. They do want to live vicariously through us, I think. If they don't, then if it's just me, well, you know, they do definitely live vicariously through me. They enter me and participate in my life all the time. And I'm very used to it. It doesn't bother me. And it seems the other thing that happens is this incredible, I'm in a sort of, my writing life is like I'm in a writing group now. I'm not alone anymore. Anne is certainly involved. And there are other aspects of the presence involved too. So that when I'm working, I'm absolutely working in a group, and I'm very aware of that.
I have, I wouldn't say similar experience, but I got to a point in researching and writing this book where I really felt like I was getting help from elsewhere, as if the universe was somehow writing this book through me, because I would have incredible coincidences that would occur that would bring a piece of information to me at a critical point in time.
Exactly.
And I could live a million, skeptics will say, oh, you only notice a coincidence when it has meaning. Well, I could live a million lives, and I would never have a coincidence that have had the kind of meaning that I've had while writing this book.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what happens to me. And I think that when someone comes along who has a really maybe to them useful approach, they're going to become involved. Now, I'd like to talk about a little bit. You mentioned Robert Sauerbacher in the piece, and of course, I had a very strange interaction with him when I was just starting out in this. He was a metallurgist. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his work?
Well, Sauerbacher was a DOD, Department of Defense contractor, and he had somehow become involved in the Roswell recovery to the point where he had knowledge of it and how it came about. My sense is that he was somebody who Majestic 12 would contract. That Majestic 12 didn't have a budget, and so they had to contract out. They had to use subcommittees and so forth. And my sense was that he was someone on one of those subcommittees, and perhaps his metallurgy expertise would be used in trying to figure out what this memory metal stuff was that they recovered in Roswell, this shape recovery material. They now call it shape recovery material. So that would be my suspicion about why Sauerbacher would be in the know about the whole Roswell deal.
Yeah, well, I read his name in a book by Stanton Friedman and called Friedman and got his what I thought was his contact information. Uh-huh. I called him and talked to him, and he asked me to write something about my experience, which I did. This was before I had written Communion. And I wrote the first piece I wrote about my experience, I sent to him by UPS overnight, as I recall. I mean, UPS overnight was just starting out. Uh-huh. And the man called me, the UPS man phoned me and said, I've tried to deliver this package, but the recipient is deceased. Robert Sauerbacher is deceased. And I jumped to the conclusion that he had died that night. But apparently now there's a disparity between the date of his death and the date that happened, meaning that I wasn't even talking to Robert Sauerbacher on the phone. I only thought I was.
Wow.
But he did say, whoever this was, did say something fascinating. He said that with regard to the metal, we found a molecular welds at the molecular level. In other words, it was welded together molecule by molecule. Wow. And he said this, it is a technology that we cannot yet even imagine, let alone accomplish.
Yeah, this post-singularity technology, they have the ability to arrange things at the atomic level.
Right. Well, they said to a close encounter witness, an abductee, years and years ago, we rearrange atoms.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, if you can rearrange atoms, you can control anything. You can do anything, essentially.
Exactly. You can engineer reality.
You can engineer reality, which gets me to my next question. I've been doing this a while, and I we're going down a bit of a road together.
Yeah.
I mentioned the film Bliss a little while ago, which is essentially a film about engineered realities. Do you think it's possible that that's what this is? Because as soon as my wife passed away, one of the first things she said was, Whitley, it's a game.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely what I think it is. I think a video game is a great analogy for what we're living through. The modern video games, the objective of the game is to gain enough knowledge and tools to attain the next level. And the next level is more challenging and more sophisticated. And, you know, what we're looking at here is essentially the same type deal. You live lifetimes that present certain challenges. And if you're able to meet those challenges, I believe you get to promote it to the next level of existence, so to speak. You know, it's that whole, the thing that the ET allegedly said to Corso in New Mexico, it's a new world if you can take it.
Right. I sat across a table from Corso with Ann and a couple of other people, and he actually told us that. I believe Linda Howe was there and a few other people. And it's in his book, but his book's full of kind of fanciful stuff, too. I mean, things that you'd think could never have been true.
Yeah, well, that's the whole post-singularity world is full of fanciful things. I mean, if you can engineer reality, you can make anything. The scientist Terry Mullis, Nobel Prize winning chemist who invented PCR, had an encounter with a glowing raccoon.
Right. And it said, good evening, Dr. Mullis. I knew Carrie very well. Or not fairly well. Yeah. I knew Carrie pretty well and his wife. Right.
In a situation like whether you have access to that technology, I mean, they could present you with any reality.
I want to talk now. I think there's just so much richness here. One of the fun things about this book, folks, just open it to any page at random, and you're going to find something fabulously interesting and helpful, profoundly helpful, because it's so clear. It enables you to organize your mind around this very, very big subject in a very big, important way. It gives you a better mind, is what it does. I want to talk about John von Neumann and the von Neumann probe, which you discuss quite extensively in the book.
Yes.
I think this is a terribly important idea. And the reason is this. When I was the one time I was really close to this in a completely physical, normal state of consciousness, I had the most brain-bending experience of my life. Not the most, but it was up there. And I've had so many brain-bending experiences. I have a file cabinet full of them at this point. In any case, I heard at this moment, and my listeners know this story, and if you don't know it, you'll find it in the book Breakthrough. I was called to go to see, to have a face-to-face with the visitors early one February morning, and I was too scared. I walked to the edge of the woods that they were just behind, and I could see their craft and some figures standing there.
through the woods, but I didn't have the guts to go down. And when I turned around and walked back to the house, when I touched the doorknob, I heard three cries above the woods. These cries were the richest sounds emotionally I've ever heard. They were filled with sadness and something else even deeper. They were very rich emotionally, but they were so precisely delivered. It was like they were delivered not just by a machine, but by a perfect machine.
Yes.
And their precision was such that for months after that, the most beautifully executed music sounded like mud to me.
Wow.
Now, tell us about the von Neumann probe. That's a lead-in. Oh, no, wait a minute. Well, wait. Free Dreamlanders, I've got great news and a fabulous idea. Stop listening to these commercials. It's simple. Go to unknowncountry.com, plunk down $5, and become a subscriber. Easy. Otherwise, just keep on listening. Here we go.
When Plato's ancestor Solon received the story of Atlantis from this Egyptian priest, the Egyptian priest said to him, "Many and manifold are the destructions of mankind. You know of but one, but you Greeks are like children. There are many, many destructions of mankind by all various types of means."
That's an excerpt from a show with Rand Flemath, who wrote the original book about crustal shift that is based on the theories of Charles Hapgood. There are three Dreamlands with Rand over the years. That one's from 2015. He goes all the way back to 2004, and they are totally relevant and totally fascinating right now. All you have to do to locate those shows is go to our search engine on unknowncountry.com and input the words Flemath, F-L-E-M-A-T-H, his last name, and all of the shows will pop up. And then, if you want to listen to these incredible programs, literally available nowhere else on earth, as far as I know, you can subscribe to unknowncountry.com for $4.95 a month or $39.50 a year. And when you do, you get a literal wealth of enjoyment from this website, including the full-length Dreamland every week, every new Dreamland that comes up. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to the site and click on the subscribe tab. Get started. Now, subscribers can also listen through any app that accepts subscription-based podcasts. One that we use is the Castro app, and it works great. You can have Dreamland pushed to your app every week. Subscriber now, just as you can, as a free Dreamlander.
Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
We're talking to Steve Lazarus. His dynamic book, The Day After the Singularity, UFOs and the Great Technological Quantum Leap. Before we left the air for the Free Dreamlanders, I will remind them that we were just getting ready to talk about the von Neumann probe. Can you tell us a little bit about Dr. John von Neumann? Who was he?
Yeah, Dr. John von Neumann was referred to by his colleagues as the smartest man in the world. He was a mathematician, an unparalleled genius, and he was partially responsible for inventing computing. And he conceived of a machine known as a universal constructor that could build copies of itself and any other machine. And the way this concept works in the Von Neumann probe in exploring and potentially colonizing the galaxy is that you could launch a Von Neumann probe at another star system. It would, when it gets there, locate the materials it needs to construct other probes like itself, build a bunch of copies, and launch them at different star systems. And by this method, you could explore the whole galaxy and potentially colonize it within a few million years, just by sublight speeds, not even greater than light speeds. So the Von Neumann probe, really the impact, it's like somebody else should have done this if we're not alone in the universe. Somebody that came for us that got to this point of developing computing and so forth should have already colonized the galaxy is the implication of the Von Neumann probe. And I think this is what has happened, except the technology is so far beyond what Von Neumann and others who took his concept and ran with it. A really good description of this can be found in a book by an astronomer and an astrobiologist, Frank Tipler and John Barrow, called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. And they really calculated out how you could do this with the technology back then, which was in the 80s. And the big question is, well, if we can do this, you know, why hasn't anyone else? And the answer is, well, of course they have. The Von Neumann probe itself, I believe that the moon is essentially the Von Neumann probe in our case. It's also what's known as an O'Neill colony. An O'Neill colony is a habitat in space where humans could live. It's biological, like a giant tube with earth and trees and water and streams, and basically an artificial environment, like an ark in space. And if you combine the two concepts of Von Neumann probe and O'Neill colony, and you look at the moon, and you understand the moon's role in bringing about intelligent life on Earth, and the fact that UFOs have been heavily associated with the moon, it looks like a base of operations, like a factory. So that's the significance of the Von Neumann probe. I think we have one circling the planet.
I think that we may be the outcome of Von Neumann probe, a very old one. Because as you mentioned earlier, the moon-Earth system looks designed.
Yeah.
So, and yet, isn't it true that we have, that it seems that the moon is basically it either broke off or there was a huge impact and this other body broke off of the Earth and the crater is the Pacific Ocean? Go ahead and talk about that.
Well, I don't know about the impact. I'll just be honest about that. I think definitely the moon is made from the body of the Earth. I mean, that's pretty much been confirmed scientifically. The isotopic ratio of moon materials is the same as Earth, meaning it came into existence at this location in space. Otherwise, if it came from somewhere else, it would have different isotopic ratios.
The moon is Adam's rib. Do you suppose Genesis is not about the creation of Adam and Eve, that part of Genesis at all, but about the creation of the Earth-Moon system?
Yeah, sure, certainly could be.
It's fascinating.
Absolutely. Back in those days, 2,000 years ago, how would you possibly explain this to anyone other than using mythological ways of doing it?
Yeah, because there would be no way to. Well, there's a fabulous book called Hamlet's Mill, which details a message left in stone by the past for our time, that they knew that they could not leave the message any other way. And right. What the message is that the Earth normally is very placid and things go on quite regularly, but then every once in a while it goes mad as a hatter and goes totally crazy. And the past sent us from the very deep and distant past a warning of something that we now know to be true, indeed the Earth does go berserk every once in a while. It happened 12,000 years ago.
Yeah. The last time we had an ice age where everything melted, there was pretty much every civilization of that time period has a flood story in their history. Dr. Paul LaViolette wrote an interesting book about that called Earth Under Fire, which he conjectures that that whole thing was caused by, the reason the sun flared as it did and so forth during that time is that a giant wave of cosmic radiation erupting from the galactic core had pushed a lot of cosmic dust at the sun.
Okay, I'm having fun kind of making this a kind of magazine show and moving from subject to subject because Steve has got a... We're not dealing with a small mind here. This is a big one, and it's full of fascinating, incredible stuff. Okay, Steve, so let's shift gears again. A person wakes up in a room full of what appear to be aliens, and he is interacted with, or she, and it's difficult for this individual. They can't do anything about it. They are returned home, and they gradually... memories that are so strange that they can't believe they even have them form. What is your idea about what is actually happening there?
Well, it was really hard to say. Everybody reacts a little bit differently to everything, but the bodies that we inhabit now, the minds that we inhabit now, function by filtering out most of reality. Otherwise, we couldn't deal with it. So anyone in that situation might find their ability to sort out reality challenged when they come into contact with something that is outside their experience of what is possible in reality. So how the mind reacts to that, I've just sat there stunned a few times when some of these events have occurred to me, and you just... I just would be flummoxed for a certain period of time, and then it's like your brain flips back on, and you have to go on with your life. So I would say I experienced during some of these things just being like frozen for like the brain freeze until it unskips and you can go on.
And yet it happens. It happens all the time. Probably half the listeners to this show have had it happen to them. That's why they're here.
Right. Right.
And we don't know what it is. You know, folks, what folklore is? Folklore is what is generated when people try to explain things that they have observed but don't understand. This is why I always say that the modern UFO narrative is essentially a folklore, because it's something that we don't understand. And I include in that the official world as well, because they don't understand it either.
Sure, it's beyond all of us. We're approaching a time when we should be able to understand. I think that's really, I don't think contact will happen until after we get through, open contact. I think we'll be basically on par with them if we survive this thing. And they no longer have to worry about crashing our civilization. And so it's possible that they're all along been trying to guide us through this eye of the needle type situation we're in.
Well, in the final half hour of our time together, we're going to concentrate on some extraordinary UFO events, such as the Mexico City eclipse, the Washington 1952 Washington event, and Stevensville, Texas, and discuss what all of these things mean, because I've not mentioned one of them that is a conventional UFO sighting. They all have something else about them. But what is it, and how does that relate to the incredible mystery of what is actually happening to that person, like Whitley and like so many others, who opens their eyes in a little room and finds themselves face to face with the unknown. Free Dreamlanders, it is, has always been a great pleasure having you with us. And I'm not even going to tell you what you should be doing now because you already know. Thank you for being with us on Dreamland, and we'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.